I want to invite our children to come forward for a combo time with young disciples and scripture reading here with Miss Laura. Come forward if you are a child or if you have been cast.
King Nebuchadnezzar made a huge golden statue. It's so beautiful. It was 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. And he was so proud of it that he called all the leaders together for the dedication of his statue. Congregation, you're all the people. You're the chief administrators, the ministers, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials. And you assembled and stood before the king's great statue. You all, excellent acting. I see it. All right. The king's herald proclaimed his news. When you hear the sound of the horn and the pipe and the lyre and the harp and the flute and every kind of instrument, you must bow down and worship the gold statue that the king Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And anyone who does not bow down and worship will be thrown immediately into the furnace of fire. Excellent. All the people bowed, and then they sat down. Very good. And they worshipped the gold statue, but not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When King Nebuchadnezzar heard about this, he went into a violent rage. Yes. And he called to the three, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, is it true you don't serve my gods or worship the statue that I've set up? I will give you a second chance. When you hear the music, bow down and worship my gold statue, or else you'll be thrown straight into the furnace of fire. Then what god could rescue you from my power? But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we cannot worship the statue. We only worship our God. And if our God, the one we serve, rescues us from the furnace of flaming fire and your power, then let him rescue us. But if he doesn't rescue us, your majesty, we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue that you have set up. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage, and his face was twisted beyond recognition. Yes. He commanded that the furnace be heated to 7 times its normal heat. So hot. But he doesn't know. He said, throw them on. We bound them up and threw them into the fire. And there they went, all bound up. Okay, to join them, angel. Come on in. Join the fire. But get inside. You're inside with them. Yes. And even though our fire is really hot, it's going to just lower a little bit so we can see all of our friends. Okay, perfect. King Nebuchadnezzar jumped in shock. Didn't we throw 3 men into the fire? But look, there's they're walking around, not bound up. They're not even hurt. Are you hurt? No. The fourth one even looks like a god. Nebuchadnezzar said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come out, servants of God Most High, come out of the furnace. And they came out of the fire. Everyone gathered to look at them, and they were not singed or burned or even smell of smoke. And Nebuchadnezzar declared, may the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be praised. He sent his angel to rescue them from the fire. The men did not obey my law, but they trusted God. I now issue a decree to all the people. Yes. To every nation and language, may no one speak disrespectfully of this God. because there is no other God who can rescue like this. And then he praised Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God, and they were prosperous thereon. The end.
Very good acting. Thank you.
Good morning, church. You know what was the most fun about that whole thing? Was that usually when things happen in the front at church, it's children who are up here and parents who are sitting, squatting in the aisle to film them. And this time it was reversed. Katie was down here filming her dad. That was great. Well, I have a little bit of show and tell today. This here is the Bible that I was given in third grade by my home church in Plano, Texas, Christ United Methodist Church. Shout out to Christ Church. I highlighted my name. Do you see that? I wanted to be sure everybody knew. So that was my Bible that I was given in third grade. You can see, I mean, it's old, but, you know, I'm not sure that it really got used, maybe at all. Then this here is the Bible that I... it's the first Bible that I really read in any significant way. And as you can see, there are some differences. I did still write Taylor's Bible along the pages there. But this one got a lot of work, you know. It got a lot of use and actually probably stuck with me until college. And I've kept it ever since. I got it when I was in middle school. It's got the date. October 5th, 1993, and that was around the time that that my own faith journey really started to take off, and that happened to be right about the same time as a significant shift in how Christians in America were being taught to approach the Bible. You see, for generations, the focus had been on biblical literacy. Knowing the stories, remembering the word, memorizing verses. But in the late 20th century, this move was underway to help Christians move beyond strict knowledge of the Bible. And instead, we wanted people to be able to apply the Bible to their lives. So, hence, my parents and I all got Life Application Bibles. Anybody else have a Life Application Bible? This was an effort to demonstrate that the Bible is really relevant to our real lives, whether we are children or teenagers or adults, that the Bible is there as a roadmap to show us how to live biblically, right? So according to Meredith Miller in this book, Woven, that we're studying a lot this fall, and you heard from Pastor John about the different conversations and study groups that are going to be looking at this really important book during the month of September. We're looking at it through a different lens here in worship for these weeks, the next few weeks. So in the book, Woven, she says that the way that we learned to read this in this relevant kind of way was to pay the greatest amount of attention to the people in the Bible as exemplars of faith, examples of what to do, and then sometimes examples of what not to do, right? So our approach to the Bible and to its stories was to look to these human characters in the Bible and ask ourselves, is this a hero that we should copy, or is this an anti-hero that we should, you know, learn from? And in this way of reading the Bible, the characters were merely illustrations. The characters were supporting evidence for broader principles that we should follow. So it was things like, maybe some of you learned these things. Be faithful like Abraham. Be courageous like Esther. Be patient like Joseph. Anybody learn those kind of Sunday school lessons? I taught them. So, in effect, in our eager pursuit of this life application, We learned to read the Bible by mining the stories for these sort of timeless, bite-sized nuggets of wisdom, principles that we can then kind of pack away and carry in our pockets for our whole lives long. The idea is to read the Bible kind of as a self-help manual. If anybody remembers the band DC Talk, Devin, I know you do, they said it really well, and I don't know that they actually invented this acronym, but they made it famous for sure. B-I-B-L-E, Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth, right? It's a self-help manual. It's a how-to book. Today's story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is one of my favorite Bible stories. When I took Introduction to Preaching in seminary, the first assignment was to pick a story, any story in the Bible, and tell it in whatever way you want to tell it. And I picked this story, in fact. I didn't tell it as good as they did just now. So if we take this story and we apply the approach of life application, then we might draw some nugget, some principle like this. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who I like to call Rack, Shack, and Benny, just like them, you and I should stand up for God no matter what. And then God will take care of us. Does that sound about right? That's kind of the principle we probably would come up with. Stand up for God no matter what, and God will take care of you. Meredith Miller helps us to see that reading the story in this way, it leads us to believe that God is like a bystander in our lives, that God is standing over here, and God is watching us, and God is evaluating our choices, right? And God likes us a little bit more or a little bit less, depending on whether we get it right or not. And if God likes us, then we just may get out of the furnace alive. That's the way that plays out. Reading the story in this way, it makes Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego into these giants of faith that we should strive to be, and if all else fails, just pretend to be. It leaves little room for them or for us to be human, to be scared and confused or unsure of themselves. Miller invites us instead to start with God, to reframe the whole story with God as the main character. So instead of hunting down these little timeless principles, these little nuggets of wisdom, she invites us to back up and to receive the story as a part of the larger story of what God is doing in the world. Now, that's not as tidy. It's a lot more complex and nuanced. We enter into the story alongside Rack, Shack, and Benny, and they look a lot more like us than we thought. When this conquering king, Nebuchadnezzar, comes along and he has sent the Hebrew people into exile, and what that means for them is that their God has been reduced to a laughingstock, that God was unable to save God's own people, probably unable to save anybody, right? Clearly inferior to this king who has conquered, the winner, right? So for these three guys and for all of the Hebrew people, the question really was, do we continue to trust God? God who kind of lost? Or do we bow to the gods of Babylon and to the king who appears to be more powerful? Who do we trust to protect and provide for us? These three young men, they don't take a stand as a performance of their own righteousness. No, even they admit that they're really not sure how this is going to turn out. Maybe we'll die. But even then, even in death, we trust God. Even if it doesn't work, they choose to trust in God. I wonder what helped them decide what to do. I wonder what stories they were remembering in that moment, what they had learned about God in all of their years before that helped them to know what to do. I wonder if they felt less sure than they sounded. I remember times when I wasn't sure whether to trust God, when it seemed like God wasn't anywhere near what I was going through. I can think of times when the fire was burning in my life. And I can't really explain it, but I could tell that God was with me in the middle of it. I don't really remember how we got through it exactly. It was a complicated process, but I know that I'm here to tell you about it today. And remembering that helps me to trust that God will be there the next time the heat rises. In the midst of a hard time in her own life, a fiery furnace, if you will, the musician Leslie Jordan penned these lyrics. She said, I can't taste the sweetness of your mercy, but I feel the sting of grief here in my chest. And I'm not sure I've known the one without the other, but I will cling to the belief that I know best. You have been, and you will be. You are so good to me. I reach out my hand in hopes that you'll hold on. And time again, I find empty space. But I will keep them open even though they're shaking and call to mind the times that I have felt that grip of grace. Because you have been and you will be. You are still here with me. It's a song of one who has internalized the story, who has learned over time and experience that God can be trusted even when it seems like God is absent. Even when it feels like we are alone, there is a fourth person in the fire. It is in God's very nature not to leave us in the fire alone. We don't read the Bible in order to prize its human characters, to lionize them or to carve big marble statues of them and all of their perfection, supposed perfection. Instead, we read it to get to know the God who hung with those very human people in their fleeting heroic moments and in their disastrous failures, so that we might begin to trust that God hangs with us in the very same way. We read it to find that God has been forever determined to work in the world, determined to redeem unredeemable situations and to make broken people whole. And God does that both with and in spite of God's human partners. So I wonder if maybe, just maybe, as we learn to approach the Bible in this new way by starting with God, I wonder if we may discover a God-first way of looking at the world and at our lives. These days, we are asking, what do we do when things feel so out of control? What is our posture in a violent world that is more likely to turn gardening tools into guns rather than the other way around? What should we do when everything around us reeks of moral decay, of power grabbing, and of a me-first ideology, when the worst keep winning and we seem to be slipping closer and closer into chaos? What do we do? The temptation here is, it's the very same as it is in our Bible reading. We're tempted to look to the humans first, to ourselves first, to figure out what we can do or should be doing. We look to ourselves and we often work ourselves into this dizzying oscillation between striving to solve all of the world's problems and then despairing at just how ineffective we are at doing so. We have to do something, and so we work, and strive. And then nothing we do is helping. And so we self-medicate with snacks and social media and other things. Back and forth we go between striving and despair, two steps forward, three steps back, until we are exhausted and we are jaded. And the best that we can do feels like to numb ourselves to the pain around us, or to build walls and enclaves that protect us enough so that we can pretend the pain isn't out there and in here. How do we do something different? How do we stop swinging between fruitless striving and resignation? How do we live lives of grounded, sustainable engagement? I believe the answer is start with God. We don't sweep away the pain and cover over the carnage. Instead, we lay it bare before God. We hold out our trembling hands that are weighed down with the bodies of school children, with the bodies of pregnant girls, with the bodies of missing immigrants, and the bodies of Gaza's children. We hold out our trembling hands and we say, it is too much. Close your eyes with me a moment. It is too much, God. We can't hold it all. We need you to hold it with us, for us. We don't know what you are doing. We can't see you in the fire. But we believe that you are here and that you are a God of death and resurrection. And so we will let our desperation be a gift that leads us not to ourselves, but to you. You who hold heaven and earth, past, present, and future. You who heal blind eyes and withered hands and hard hearts. You who provided in the wilderness. You who traded power for submission and thus rewrote the end of all of our stories. We are in the hard middle of the story now, O Lord. Be here in the fire with us. Help us to trust, to stay close to you who are always closest to the suffering. And to trust the end of the story that you have written. And that you are writing with us even now. Amen.